Hello, and welcome to the webinar on MomsFightingAutism.com. My name is Chantal Cecile Kira, and I'm the moderator for this evening. I'm also the author of three books. My latest is Autism Life Skills, From Communication and Safety to Self-Esteem and More, 10 Essential Abilities Every Child Needs and Deserves to Learn. My guest today is Patricia Cromer, who is an attorney working in special education. She has been practicing law since 1995, exclusive in the area of special education, and she is also a parent of two special needs eligible children, as well as an attorney representing over 1,000 families. She also has worked with the juvenile court system to provide cost-effective representation to foster children who the law left without protection, as well. She also trains judges, attorneys, and other agencies that work in the juvenile court system, as well as parents and CASAs in the children's special education rights, and also how to protect children. Now, I've heard word from Patty that she is stuck in traffic, so unfortunately, I'm going to have to start without her, and I'm hoping that she'll be able to join us because there are so many interesting questions that are here. Meanwhile, however, though, I will be reviewing some of the tips that have been provided by Protection Advocacy, which is an organization in California, in regards to providing getting a good education for your child and making sure that you have quality special education services. Now, the first thing that I'd like to say is that every state in the United States has a protection and advocacy office which provides free information as to the rights to special education for your child. So it has a different name in each state. I know that in the state of California it is Protection and Advocacy, Inc., PAI, and it's a nonprofit organization. So every state has a nonprofit organization, just the name may be different, but if you go on your computer and Google Protection and Advocacy Special Education Law, you should be able to find it. And what's great about these offices is that they provide information about the laws, but translated into common English so that anybody can understand it. It's also translated into many, many different languages. I can't even remember exactly how many languages in the state of California, but something like 18. And I know it's the same in other states. So it's very important that you look online. Many of these offices actually have available online all the questions that could possibly be asked in terms of special education law. If they don't have it online, they will send it to you or tell you where to obtain it for free. Another thing that's great about these protection advocacy agencies is that they will provide you with information and the help of an attorney or an advocate that you can talk to over the phone. Of course, there's a lot of people asking for these services. So, for example, when I tried to get information many years ago when I first moved to the state of California, I would have to call and give them an idea of what my question was and leave a message, and it would take up to 3 or 4 days for them to get back to me. So it's kind of hard to call them for an instantaneous response, but you will get advice from them. The other thing that I want to say before getting started here is I want to put out the disclaimer that none of the advice that I'm giving you should be taken as legal advice specific to your case. This is practical information gleaned from my experience and also information that's been given to me, research done in writing for my books. When Ms. Cromer is on the line, she can discuss more what her experience is from her background as a legal representative. So first of all, I'm going to talk about 18 tips for getting quality special education services for your child. This was prepared by the senior attorneys Ellen S. Goldblatt and Dale Mentenk, who are senior attorneys at Protection Advocacy in the state of California. And they gave this to me for a printing in my first book, Autism Spectrum Disorders, because I have a chapter in there on education. So the first tip that they suggested in terms of the IEP meeting was to be prepared. The thing about special education, no matter where you are in the United States, is that the IEP meeting is very important because, in essence, that's where the contract is written between the parents and the team of people that will be providing the education, the school district, for your child. So in my experience, it should be really thought of as a business meeting because you're going to be negotiating. And so the thing that's really important to know is no matter what you think about what kind of education your child should be having, it has to be specifically written in the IEP, the Individualized Educational Program document that comes up, that is made up from this meeting. So the goals have to be specific and all the services that your child will be receiving, be it OT or speech or whatever it is that has been decided by the team that your child needs. So that's why when they talk about the 18 tips for getting the right education for your child, they immediately start about what you should be doing before the IEP meeting, because that contract that you're going to be putting together during the IEP meeting is really the most important thing that's going to lay out your rights for your child for his education. So the first thing you want to do is request the needed assessments in writing or get independent assessments for your child. Your child can be assessed in any area of suspected disability and for any services needed for him to benefit from school. For example, assessments may be done of reading or math levels on the modifications needed to fully include your child for therapy services such as occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech, mental health, and to identify assistive technology like a communication device. If you would disagree with the school district's assessment, you can obtain an independent assessment at public expense. Always request assessments in writing. An assessment plan must come in 15 days. Once you sign the plan, the assessment must be completed and the IEP meeting held in 50 days, with some exceptions. Okay, so what they mean by an assessment plan must come in 15 days means that if your school district is asking to provide or to do certain assessments on your child, this assessment plan must be sent to you in writing at least 15 days before they plan on doing the assessments. Now, the tip number two is to ask to obtain assessment reports 1 week before an IEP meeting. Whether you or the school district requested the assessments, ask the school early on to provide you with top assessment reports a week before the IEP meeting. This is very important so that you can read the reports, discuss them, and plan for the meeting. Now, the reason why you want to obtain the assessment reports before an IEP meeting is because if you get them during the IEP meeting, you're not going to have time to read the information that's in them and assess whether yes or no you agree, because sometimes you may not agree with the assessment that's been provided by a certain professional. And also, when you have the time to reflect on what an assessment has to say about your child, then you can have, it gives you more time to think about what this means in terms of your child. The third tip that was given in terms of getting quality special education services for your child was to plan for the meeting with a friend or advocate. So in planning for your child's IEP, you may want to contact a local advocacy organization or parent advocacy group. All states have a protection advocacy agency, and depending on where you live, there may be other advocacy resources or attorneys who specialize in special education law. Or buddy up with another family and assist each other to plan for IEPs. This is a really good idea. It's so much easier to have the help of an advocate or a family, another family, not necessarily saying this, you're not going to get legal advice from these people, but you're going to get the support, and also they will be thinking about you may not be thinking of. Patty, are you on the line?
I am.
Oh, good. I was waiting. I thought I heard someone on there, but...
I didn't want to interrupt you.
Okay, so we're directly online with people who are listening in, and I had explained that you were late due to traffic, and
thank
I was
you.
Hoping you were going to join. And meanwhile, I was reading the 18 tips for getting quality special education services for your child. That was from Protection Advocacy Organization in California. I don't know if you want me to go ahead and finish that up in 5 minutes.
That's fine.
Okay, and then we can get started on some questions after you may introduce yourself. I've already told them a little bit about you, but you'll probably want to say more.
Okay.
So I'm going to do this a little more quickly now that I know you're here. I have a lot of good questions that relate to some of these things. So tip number four is review any assessment reports with this person. So identify your aims for the meeting and think about what your child accomplished last year and what you hope they will learn next year. Identify the special difficulties or strengths of your child that you want to bring to the school's attention. If you are seeking full inclusion or increased integration, identify how your child interacts with non-disabled children outside of school and what makes it successful. Tip number five, consider full inclusion or increased integration. The law says that to the maximum extent appropriate, as decided by the IEP team, children with disabilities shall be educated in their neighborhood schools and attend regular classes with supplemental aids and services. These placements are called full inclusion. Today, many researchers and parents believe all children with disabilities can and should be fully included. You should definitely consider before the IEP meeting whether you want your child fully included or simply wanting to increase her integration opportunities in classroom and or extracurricular activities. Tip six, make a list of the points you want to raise at the IEP meeting. However well you plan, you may get nervous or distracted at a meeting with several professionals. Thus, it is good to make a list of points and questions in advance so you won't forget. You can check off points as they are discussed and jot down the answers to your questions. This is really important. I know I forget things when I get to a meeting. I also should make a disclaimer that these 18 tips were written 5 years ago. So Patty may be thinking about things that are in here that she may want to clarify, but they're pretty general. You're listening, right, Patty?
Yes, I am.
Okay. At the IEP meeting, bring a friend or an advocate or a person who knows your child. You can invite anyone you want to your child's IEP. It's always a good idea to have someone with you. And I'll tell you why that is. It's because it's really good to have someone else writing notes for you, taking notes. And I always bring somebody with me. If my husband can't make it, I have a good friend with me, even if she knows absolutely nothing about special education, but I give her the list of things I want to make sure that I want to discuss, because I love to talk, and so I always forget that sometimes the meeting's going well and everybody's talking, and sometimes you don't get to those very important points that you needed to make sure were included in your child's IEP or that you wanted to have discussed. So I have this person kick me under the table and point to the paper to remind me, get focused back on what we're supposed to make sure we get to in this meeting. So that's a really good point. Number four, review. I wasn't on number four. I was on number eight. You see, I'm better at talking than reading. Number eight, don't be afraid to ask questions and make sure you understand any jargon. Schools are required to explain all findings and recommendations in easily understandable language. District staff use the same terms every day and may forget that the world doesn't know what they mean. Some parents don't ask questions because they feel it makes them appear unintelligent or unsophisticated. The fact is that most intelligent and sophisticated persons often ask the most questions. Number nine, discuss the present level of your child's performance. Discuss reports, assessments, and your own and the teacher's observations of your child's performance. Record his abilities and issues. Number 10, develop annual goals and short-term objectives. Number 11, identify full inclusion or integration opportunities and the supports needed for success. Okay, that's an important point right there, the supports needed for success. Inclusion is not just about throwing somebody in a classroom. Point number 12, describe the placement for your child and identify specifically the supports and related services needed. Point number 13, sign the IEP only if you are satisfied. You do not need to sign the IEP at the meeting. You can take it home to discuss it with others and think about it. In fact, I always do that. I always take the IEP home, wait 24 hours, and reread it because, again, no matter how well things are going at a meeting, sometimes there's something that's forgotten or else is not listed in the correct spot in the IEP, and I always like to make sure that everything's done correctly. So here's the last few points. After the IEP meeting, meet your child's teachers at the beginning of the year, be a classroom volunteer if possible, and or participate in school activities. Parents have different amounts of time and money. Analyze your situation and then contact the teacher or school to determine how you could be of assistance. This is just helpful so you can have an eye and an ear out there to see what's going on in the environment where your child is. Tip number 15, support your child in developing friendships with her classmates. Assist your child in calling friends outside of school and to make play dates. Number 16, monitor your child's progress. You may want to arrange for a regular communication system with your child's teacher, such as that notebook that goes back and forth to school. Note projected target dates for your child to master particular skills and ask the teacher to let you know of the progress. Okay, if things don't work out, tip number 17, you can file a compliance complaint if the school district does not follow the law or fails to provide services required in a signed IEP. Tip number 18, you can file for a due process hearing if you and the school district cannot agree on the special education services appropriate for your child. Well, now I'd like again to introduce Patty Cromer. And
thank
Patty,
you.
I explained that you've been practicing law since 1995 exclusively in the area of special education and that you've been a parent of two special needs eligible children as
well as
an attorney in over 1,000 families. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I also did my little disclaimer at the beginning of what I was talking about was not a specific legal advice to individuals, but was more my practical knowledge from writing my books and my own experience. But I don't know if you wanted to put a little disclaimer out there for any information you may be giving out.
Well, clearly I practice in California, and so more of my knowledge is based upon California law. And since I don't have anybody's IEP or ED records in front of me, my responses to the questions that have been sent are really generic. And I'm not giving you legal advice.
Okay. Well, we have a lot of interesting questions here. And
excuse me.
I wanted to know, did you want to talk a little bit specifically about your topic, what you don't know can hurt your child in the IEP process? Did you want to start before we ask, before I go over any questions, an overview of the changes in the law and how they impact a child's placement?
I did. One of the things that has changed majorly, at least within my state and its applicability, is the federal system, which generates the laws under IDEA, came out and they update them periodically, and they decided that districts were too vulnerable when they start to implement something and then a parent goes back and changes their mind about what they want. It used to be that if you signed an IEP document, left your meeting, went home, and even 6 months later you decided, I really didn't mean for this to be the placement that my child was in. They talked me into it. I acquiesced to the pressure I felt at that meeting. You could send in what's called a dissent, which is a disagreement, and that's D-I-S-S-E-N-T. And that's a disagreement to the IEP, removing your consent for those portions that you don't agree with. That was then retroactive back to the date of the original IEP signature. However, now, when you sign an IEP, you are locked in. That's it. You bought that IEP. So when you go to IEP team meetings, and I've sat in them, even with myself being in them and my client sitting there, and they'll hand us the form and they'll say, are you going to sign this? I said, we'll take it home and we'll sign it. Well, then we're going to put down you refusing to sign. Put down whatever they need to put down. It's who cares? It's your child. And if you were going to go buy a house or a car, especially in this economy, you'd be very, very careful what was in the mortgage or in the loan documentation for your car. So I want you to think of the IEP in the same respect as you would look at those documents, because this is your child, and clearly your child is worth a lot more than your car or your house. So whatever they have to – go ahead.
It is like a contract. It's a contract between the school district and the parents, isn't it?
Well, it's not considered a contract. It's considered an individualized educational program. And I did notice in one of the questions that was sent to me that someone asked me if it was an individual education plan. No such thing. They're called individualized education programs. And if you don't use the correct jargon, then the district knows they have you. And so it's not considered a contract, because with a contract, you have to put up something to receive something. And there's no bartering here. You're not paying for something, and your child is not getting it. So only one person has to perform in this case, and that's the school district. And here's the sad reality. There's no such thing as the IEP team police. So if you're – go ahead. If you want to go in and draft the IEP that on its face, meaning the document itself within the four corners of the document, is perfect, there's still no guarantee that anybody's going to ensure that that IEP gets implemented, or that it gets implemented the way they explain to you it's going to get implemented. And that's the sad part about it. So you have to be an investigator to ensure that your child's getting the services. But I heard you say in the documentation that you were going through from Protection and Advocacy California of the, you know, the important things about preparing for an IEP meeting is don't sign it. In the definition of when a district fails to provide a free, appropriate public education of your child, that's when a parent is denied their right to fully participate in the development of an IEP, which results in a child being denied or loss of an educational opportunity. Of course, that's lame in terms trying to keep it as simplified as possible. So what does that mean? Well, if you look at the IEP document, it used to say attendance, at least most of the ones that I've seen have, and the participants would sign as, or the people who attended would sign as being in attendance at that IEP meeting. Since the language has changed to say that the denial of FAPE is when the parent is denied the right to fully participate, the majority of the IEP documents themselves now say participants, or have a section that says, I fully participated in the development of this IEP for my child, or I participated in the development of this IEP. Well, if nothing that you said was heard, and it was pretty much an IEP that was developed before you got there, did you fully participate? I tell my clients and I tell everybody that I train to do this, that you should sign that section, attendance only. Because if I was an attorney for the district, I would say party admission that they fully participated. Right here it says participants and they signed. So I'd be very careful about how you sign an IEP document. And then when you get to the IEP team meeting, there has been multiple changes in the law that, at least in this state, I mean, nationwide there has been, but in this state there's been a series of changes in the law that impact all special needs kids. And so when you get to the IEP meeting and they say, here's a copy of your IEP, your parents' rights, do you want us to go over them? Nobody wants to sit there and have them read the 15 pages or the 7 pages single space that they give you and go through it ad nauseum because you've heard it all before. But the best thing you can do is say, first of all, what is the date on the IEP parents' rights document to tell you what date they last updated that document? And I was finding that a lot of things that went into effect, say 1/1/09, districts were still handing out parents' rights from 2007. So none of the changes in the law federally or for the state of California were being provided to my clients for the past 2 years, and there were quite a few. So you need to be very, very proactive of asking, what is the date of the update on that document, and then what were the changes from the last time we met? And if they don't know, then you can ask them to go through everything. The point is that if you don't ask them what's changed, they're not going to tell you. And in reality, they may not even know themselves. So you need to be proactive for your child and ask them the date of the document, that is the parents' rights form, and what has changed since the last time you've got it. I know my clients feel like they just don't want another copy because they could probably wallpaper their bathrooms, and that's true, but please find out what are the changes and get a copy of that. If they were to give you a copy that is 2 years old, where it says, I've received my parents' rights, you should put on there, but they're from February 2007 and therefore are not providing me all of my rights to date. The other thing you can also do is check what the language is. Many of the IEPs that I'm seeing now say, I have been provided a copy of my parents' rights and understand them. I always instruct the people I work with to strike and understand them. Because in reality, if you really do understand them, then please come to work for me. Because sometimes I wonder if I understand them and this is all I do for a living.
Right.
So be very, very careful. There's nothing worse than a parent coming to my office saying, I want to invoke stay put to the last IEP. Well, did you sign the IEP that you went to? Well, yeah, they told me I had to sign it or they weren't going to give my child services. That is not true. Unless it is the initial IEP document that initiates and starts services for the child, the last document that you agreed to remains in effect until it is replaced by the new annual IEP document. So please don't misunderstand that what they're telling you is correct, because it's not. You want to make sure that you leave that IEP team meeting with the document in hand. The other thing that they like to do now that they're all going to computerize is say, oh, here's the sign-in sheet. Well, could I have a copy of the IEP? Well, after you sign it, we'll lock it in, and then we're going to send it to you. Well, what happens if half the stuff that you talked about in the IEP team meeting and think is in the IEP and you get it home and finally get a copy of it and it's not? You've already signed it. You're stuck with what you signed for. So I don't like to ever use the word never, but I do have a few nevers in special ed. Never sign an IEP document at an IEP team meeting. Also, in regard to that, I would strongly suggest that you provide them, at least in California, it's 24 hours, written notice of your intent to tape record an IEP team meeting. Now, nationwide, by federal law, you can tape record meetings. I just don't know what your timelines are or what your requirements are to initiate that ability. Once you've noticed them of your right to and that you're going to tape record, they have the right to tape record also. That's fine. Let them tape record. This way, if there's any question what was said, you can go back, you can listen to it. And some of us who are so busy trying to be involved in the IEP process, we miss some things. And then we take it back and said, wow, I didn't realize that somebody had said that. So when I get an IEP home for my clients and when I did for my own children, I would sit there and go through it with highlighters and highlight anything I didn't agree with. If they provided reports at the IEP meeting, and that's a great recommendation to have the IEP document, I'm sorry, evaluations provided prior to the meeting in your possession. If there's anything in there that you don't agree with, then when I write the dissent to the IEP, I include that. Anything that they said that I didn't like, I include that. It's also a really good idea to have a note taker. I happen to type pretty fast, so I type what's being said and participate, and it's a little unnerving to a lot of the district people that I'm capable of doing that, but that's their problem. It's not my clients or mine. And that way I have a really good record of what was said. I don't have to necessarily go back to the tape recording, but that's only because I type it about 90-plus words per per minute. So be sure that you get the best record that you can get of what was said at that IEP meeting. And then when you sign, if you agree to it, remember the law provides that you can agree in part or to whole of it or to none of it. If you agree to part of it, for instance, I agree my child continues to qualify for special education, but that they no longer require being in a special day class, which is the old term that was used for when a child received more than 51% of their time with special ed services. And so I am not consenting to that placement. Or I agree that my child continues to need speech and language related services, but I'm not agreeing to dropping it from the last IEP from 3 times a week, 30 minutes, to 2 times a week, 30 minutes. That's called consenting and dissenting in part. Some IEPs will have on it, I agree to this IEP with the exception of, and we write, see dissent, and I start, and then where the parent goes down and signs the consent line, I have them put the 3 stars, seek dissent, and then write their name, and then date it. I try to get them back to the district as soon as possible because I know my parents getting phone calls saying we have to lock up this IEP and, you know, you can only have it for 3 days. There's actually no law that says how long you can have that IEP document to review or sign or not sign. The district has to then look at what you consented to and decide if what you consented to, what you didn't consent to, denies your child, in their eyes, of a free appropriate public education, or FAPE. If it does, then they are required to file for due process and get a hearing officer or an administrative law judge, depending upon your system, to decide if that is required for your child to receive FAPE. What happens most of the time is the parent says, I'm invoking stay put. Well, the reality is that stay put is only invoked and only triggered when someone files for due process. And typically stay put has been a parent and child right. Unfortunately, I'm seeing decisions both in this state and others where the districts are being given the right to stay put. And how they're getting the right to stay put is under this new protection that they have, that if you signed the IEP at the IEP team meeting that changed it and then came back and said, now I want to dissent to what I agreed to, the stay puts to the last agreed upon IEP and you agreed to this one, so you're stuck with it, which is why, again, the never word, never signed for an IEP at the IEP team meeting. It's very difficult to sit there and let someone threaten to take your kids' services away or tell you all the horrible things that are going to happen if you don't sign the IEP at the IEP meeting. The reality is nothing's going to happen. So please feel free, and I strongly urge you, if nothing else, please hear this. Do not sign this IEP at that meeting anymore. Take it home and read it. Have somebody else read it. Go to anybody you want to read it and discuss with it and make sure that it says exactly what you want for your child so that if you have to invoke stay put, you have invoked it to the last one that you signed that had the services that you agreed to. The biggest problem I'm coming into right now with that change in the law is parents used to be able to say, I don't want my child in special day class. And I think they should be in a less restrictive environment with full inclusion and an aide. So the district makes the offer, again, of the special day class, coerces you into signing it. Plus, the last one you signed does have special day class on it because that was the placement your child was in. And then they refuse to accept, even when you sign in, that you're withdrawing consent from the stay put special day class and force you into a hearing. And the things that happen at hearing is, number one, if you are the one who filed for hearing, you have the burden of proof. You have to prove what your child's needs are, how those needs can be met, and you have to bring in your experts, for which the Supreme Court about 4 years ago decided that the law is not written for parents to receive reimbursement for their experts. So,
Patty, I had a question.
Certainly.
Is this something new now that it's up to the parent to prove? Wasn't it before that the state had to prove or the school district had to prove what was appropriate?
Well, typically most of the states took the position that it was the individual who wanted to change the placement had the burden of proof.
Yeah, I see.
I think it's Weist is the case through the Supreme Court came in and said no. whoever files has the burden of proof. So even if I filed before and I filed because the district wanted to take something away from my child, they would have had the burden because they were trying to change the placement that the child had been in. Now if I file, I have full burden.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Okay. Trying to think what else. The definition of parent on a federal level has also changed, because I know there were several questions in here from parents who are divorced, and the one parent signs agreement and one parent doesn't sign agreement. Does that amount to consent? Well, the federal register is the history of the comments that are put in front of Congress. And in the federal register, and looking at the what happened during the time that Congress was looking at the definition of parent, describes that districts were being put in this position, and they felt that it was a court's determination who controlled for the purposes of making those types of decisions. So the law was expanded in the definition of parent to bring in, yes, it's a parent unless there's a court order, then that controls. So if you have a divorce order and the judge did not delineate in that order who has the absolute final decision, should there be a dispute over educational placement or services, you should go back to your attorney and ask that that be heard in front of the court. Of course, you're also risking that it's not going to be you. I have had that resolved by having a CASA, which is a court-appointed special advocate who is trained in taking over the educational rights of a child, be appointed by the court to make the final decision. I've had attorneys appointed who do special ed law to do the final decision. I've had them say they have to go to mediation and then had the mediator have the final say. So that one I really don't recommend, because the mediators that I have been involved with in doing this don't quite get all the special ed law. So you want to try to keep this with somebody who understands. Sometimes the child has their own attorney, and if they have minors counsel appointed for them and that person is versed in special ed law, that is something that you can ask the court to have them make up their mind if the parents aren't able to come to an agreement. But, yes, typically most districts are accepting one parent signature for consent, and that makes it very, very difficult. Is it okay if I move on to some of the questions?
Sure. So I'm going to ask you some questions.
Okay.
The questions have been sent, and also there are many that are coming in.
Oh, great.
So the first question I wanted to ask you, this is from Jenny Sugarland, or Jenny from Sugarland. It's not clear. What does the U.S. Supreme Court decision last week, the public schools paying for private schools of disabled children, what does that change for special education parents?
What it changes is districts had been taking the position, especially with autistic kids, who weren't being put in the school district first, failing in a program, and then the parents were putting them in home-based Lovos ABA DTP programs or any other type. And so they tried to take it up that parents couldn't, who did that and didn't make the child available to school district programs, should not be entitled to reimbursement for public school, for a private school placement. And the Supreme Court came down and said, you know, if the child was identified or not, it's irrelevant, because under the law, the district has the responsibility to child find. That means look for these children, whether they're in private schools or regular schools, and that this was just an attempt to circumvent both child find as well as providing a free, appropriate public education. Moreover, they had decided years ago in some of the original cases that they did, the Burlington and the Raleigh cases that were the forefronts of all of these cases, that if a school district was not offering a free, appropriate public education to your child, the parents absolutely have the right to pull the child from that school and place them in a school program and have a hearing officer or a judge determine if the district had offered FAPE and if the if not, excuse me, that the parents program was appropriate for the child. So we were very, very pleased to see that, and I just see is that strengthening the position for the many autistic kids that have to be pulled out and placed in home programs.
Right. Okay.
Like, please, if I'm not being clear, let me know.
No, it's just all of a sudden it blanked out and I couldn't hear you when you were speaking.
I'm sorry. Do you want me to repeat myself?
No, just the last sentence that you said.
Just the last sentence.
Mayan, go ahead.
About
autistic children and getting...
Who have to be pulled out and placed in home programs. This preserves the parents' right to go after school districts, regardless of whether the child had been in a school district program first.
Okay, great. Now, there's a few people that ask questions that have to do with paraprofessionals, and so I'm going to take this one from Michelle in Detroit. Can you request a paraprofessional for your child? What if the school denies your request? I've spoken with many parents whose child has one, yet every time I bring it up the IEP, they tell me it is not the right thing for him.
Okay. This takes some preparation. When you are going to ask for something that you already know in advance they're going to deny you, you have to be able to support your position of why you want that for your child. So look at the IEP document. Look at all the educational records. I would always start with requesting the educational records from the school district. That's all of them, including the logs and things like that. And then you want to look and see, well, in this classroom, he doesn't stay on task, and here he doesn't, can't get started, can't stay on task or can't finish his work. So what would having an aide be able to do? You have to establish that accommodation and or related services, because in each state they call it something different, what it does to enhance the child's ability to benefit from his education. So one, you have to establish that they're not making sufficient progress, that there is a need, and that you believe that and one-to-one aid is appropriate. When you are looking at the issue of full inclusion, it is assumed that a child can be educated in regular education. And only if they can't be, and the burden is on the district, can the child then be removed from regular ed curriculum environment and placed in a more restrictive environment. Clearly, having an aide in a regular ed environment is less restrictive than being excluded into a classroom that doesn't have regular ed students in it. In the Ninth Circuit, which is where the West Coast sits, there's a four-pronged test called, I believe, the Rachel Holland test. And under that test, they look at what benefit does the child receive from being in the classroom. And that can be things like he gets to socialize with typically developing peers. He gets to see the behavior of typically developing peers. And especially with children with autism, they mimic behavior. So you clearly want him to be in a classroom where that is available to him to see, because if he's only in a classroom with other kids who are autistic and they all have some form of behavior, then they don't get to see what's appropriate behavior and mimic it. Then what's the impact to the other children? Is there a negative impact? Does the child, say, flap his hands uncontrollably, or do they stem and the stemming is interfering with other children's ability to learn? If so, that is a reason why they shouldn't be in the class, or that you should try at least having an aide. Cost is one of the issues, but it's rarely looked at. And clearly, being in a special day class versus being an aide, because most districts don't hire full-time aides with benefits and stuff, it's probably cheaper to have an aide in the classroom. So those are the things that you should look at when you want an aide. Anything in this arena that you are requesting has to be in writing. If it's not in writing, it does not exist. So if you're talking in a meeting and you're asking for a paraprofessional to be involved with your child, and I'm assuming they're talking in aid, I'm assuming they're not talking about OT or related services like that.
Oh.
But if they're talking about having an aide in the classroom, especially one that's trained in the behavior programs that work for your child, you want to put that request in writing, substantiate it with the benefit that the child would receive from it. the districts that have balked at this are trying to say, for instance, I have a deaf child who wants, the parent wants them full-time in regular ed, and they say, but he's getting a better education in the deaf and hard of hearing program. Well, that's not the issue. The issue isn't that he would be better or learn more in special day class or in a program that is secluded from the rest of the school site. It's what, where is the least restrictive environment the IEP can be implemented.
Right. But the other thing, too, I think it's important to remind parents is you don't get something because other kids are getting it or other parents are getting it for their child. They really have to demonstrate the need for their child or how it relates to their child.
Absolutely.
Right. Here we go again. Of course, it has to do with allowing a 101. How do you get the school to include your child in a traditional class? This is from Andrea Herndon from Burlington, North Carolina. She says that the school's budget won't allow for a 101 so that my child can get out of contained setting.
Well, as I just went through, really the cost isn't the major issue. The issue is the child's needs. When
but they shouldn't even be bringing that up to the parent.
Excuse me?
They shouldn't even be mentioning that to the parent.
Right. Cost is a non-issue when it comes to special education for the parent and for where's the least restrictive environment your child should be educated. Again, you need to remember that the district has the burden to establish that your child cannot be educated in a general ed classroom, not you. And if they want to bring up the school's budget as not allowing them to have a one-on-one, or for instance, some IEPs you go to and say, oh, well, your child's moving to middle school, and at middle school we only give 2 times 20 minutes a week for speech and language. Well, that's irrelevant what they give or what their policy is. They must meet the needs of the student. So, again, you want to establish what is the need from your child. What will your child get from being in the traditional classroom? Does he already have an IEP that says traditional classroom or general ed classroom, or are you going to be one of the ones locked into the last agreed upon IEP for stay put will be a special day class? That's where they get you, because most hearing officers and judges don't want to do a trial placement on a child. In other words, if the kid is in a specific, very restrictive environment, the district has built in experts. All the people that work in there can establish how the child functions in there. But there's nobody to say he would function well in the classroom, because we've seen him in the classroom with just an aide. And that's why this change in the law is so detrimental to us, is because before we were able to force their hand, withdraw consent for special day class, put them in a traditional classroom, see how he did, and then go to hearing. Now you're kind of stuck in that you don't have any experts who will have seen that child in a traditional class before you go. And I'm not sure in all the states what the likelihood is that a hearing officer or a judge is willing to take that gamble when he's got school district people. So that's a very hard position to be in.
Right.
But the budget isn't an issue. And if their excuse is merely the budget, then the Office of Civil Rights in your area is available to take referrals for discrimination, and that would be discrimination based upon a disability. And I recommend Office of Civil Rights and filling out their forms and going through them, because when you go through your state compliance or even file a complaint at your school level, it's being addressed by the people who are really funding your program, and I don't want somebody who's involved in the child's program, who's not independent, to come in and make a decision regarding a child. At least in our state, there have been a waste of time recently. So my recommendation is, if you have to do something and don't want to go to the expense of a hearing, because they can be very expensive, I would file a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights. This goes back to having to tape record that IEP meeting where your request was made and you heard the district say, we can't allow it because we don't have the funds, or if they put it in a letter to you, or if in a phone conversation they put it to you, document that phone conversation. And then a nice thing that parents can do that I can't do is you can send a letter to the teacher, for instance, and say, thank you so much for your honesty in telling me that, you know, it's not really that my son doesn't need an aide or wouldn't benefit from being in this traditional class. It's that the school district can't afford a one-on-one aide. I appreciate your honesty. Thank you for working with me. And make a copy of it front and back, hand it to her. It goes in her file. So by the time the school is looking for it, they don't even know that exists. And you have it to use as evidence against them. So that's a nice thing for parents to be able to do.
Documenting is always a good thing to do.
Absolutely. Document, document, document.
There's a couple of comments that have come in that have to do with the physical custody. Lynn from Peabody asks, so physical custody of a child does not denote who can sign the IEP? You know, she's talking about in terms of divorce cases?
Yes.
Is that right? Physical custody does not denote who can sign the IEP.
That's correct. Legal custody does. Physical custody is how much time you actually have the child. Legal custody is the rights.
Okay, so here's David from Los Angeles. Again, this is the last question I'm going to go on about custody, but what can you do when you read the IEP document, including its narrative, and is not reflective of parent collaboration and is missing agreements or important comments made at meeting? No, it was not reviewed at a meeting, nor was I given a copy till weeks later at my request. SD refuses to make changes. I guess that's school district. Special ed director allowing parent attachment, is this enough and binding? Special ed director also said we would have to meet again to discuss what I'm saying, missing, wrong, omitted, even though they have my detailed letter. I do not wish to rehash things already agreed to and discussed. I guess this is not about the custody. This is a different one. Sorry.
That's
anyway,
okay.
We did tape. I'd be happy to do an amendment to IEP without meeting. I brought this up, no response. They really want to drag us back to the table. These are their errors, not ours. What can we do?
Well, believe it or not, some districts are doing away with IEP team meeting notes for exactly this reason. They don't want to document what went on, which if that's the district you're in, and I know that's not LA Unified, but in that type of a district, make sure you absolutely document everything by tape recording. And even follow up with a letter saying, this is what I understand was covered. When an IEP document does not reflect what you believe was agreed to, you must fill out your own document called a dissent. And with that dissent, you have to identify, it's my understanding that at the IEP team meeting, so-and-so said X, so-and-so said Y, we agreed. This is not on the IEP. Absent this being part of the IEP, I believe that you have denied a free appropriate public education to my child. Now, many of the districts that I send dissents into like to answer my questions back and try to defend themselves, which is good because if you go to hearing, you now know what position they're going to take. But the reality is that the district, the individual who's writing the IEP document and taking the notes at the IEP is the one who has full control of what goes into that IEP. You as a parent only have control over consenting and dissenting.
Okay. All right, I found that letter now from the having to do with divorce and, you know, custody situations. It's from Vicki Koreski-Ewing. I am the divorced mother of a severely autistic nonverbal child in New Jersey and have recently gone through a very difficult situation regarding my daughter's IEP, which involved a change in educational placement. Supposedly there is some legal precedent that does not, that wait, that not only allows for the IEP to be implemented with no parental consent whatsoever, but allows also for its implementation in a divorce situation when only one parent consents, even when there is joint legal custody, and even when the family court judges specifically states that there is not, that is not the intent of joint legal custody. Is there anything in the new laws that will remedy this gross injustice? And if not, what can be done to counteract it? Also, why haven't both national and state autism advocacy and awareness organizations ever taken up this issue?
Well, it has been taken up, and that was the reason why they changed the definition of parent and added the section that if there was a conflict between any of the individuals who were named as parent, which were the adoptive parents, the biological parents, possibly the foster parents, possibly a guardian if they were given ed rights, then, in fact, it goes, drops down to the bottom section, which says if there's a court order that controls. So your job is to get back on the phone with your attorney and insist that she get the court to identify who makes the decision if there is no agreement between the two parents. Also, if you are the one who does not agree with the program, or even if you're the one who does agree with the program, you have to document that so that the school district knows what you agreed to and what you didn't. Some districts are now saying we're not going to implement unless we have both parents' signature. Some, their attorneys are advising them, if you have one signature, implement. So it's not standardized in that area.
Okay. Here's a great question from Christy Carter in Philadelphia. How do you get the teachers to actually follow the IEP?
You don't. The only way you're going to get them to follow an IEP, because, again, there's no IEP police, is sue them. And there have been a couple of suits. And what you're actually suing for is mostly their failure to implement the 504 components of the IEP. That is, the accommodations and modifications on a 504 plan are subsumed, are brought into an IEP. And that's your section now that where they go through this, the child require assistive technology. What accommodations or modifications does the child need in the classroom? Some districts are calling them special factors. But that, those are the incorporation of your 504 issues. So you can file a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights, and they can step in, and you can also seek an attorney. And you've got some very strong attorneys in Philadelphia who do this type of work against suing a teacher who refuses to actually implement the IEP. But you have to be able to prove it.
But wouldn't you first want to ascertain whether yes or no they're following the IEP? Because sometimes you may get the impression that they're not following the IEP, but you don't really know if you're not getting the correct progress reports and there's no communication going on. So how do you ascertain whether they're actually following the IEP or not?
Well, I'm thinking of situations where a teacher is in the IEP meeting and they say, Johnny's going to have extra time on his homework, and the teacher says, not in my class. I don't do that for anybody. I'm not going to do it. I refuse.
Oh.
I just had a child who almost didn't graduate this year because he was allowed to take the test someplace else. So he went to pick up the test and go to a smaller environment in the middle of the final, and the teacher picked it up, ripped it up, and that was that. And he refused to implement the accommodations. When you're writing accommodations and modifications on an IEP, and let me be clear with the difference between the two, because I think they're used simultaneously and they're not the same thing. An accommodation is when you change how you present or give something back. For instance, if your child is deaf of hard of hearing and they give him, you clearly don't want him to have to get up in front of the class and answer questions. So for him, he might write a paragraph. If your child is dysgraphic and writing is a problem, he might have a scribe where he dictates what he says and somebody writes it down. Or he might be put on an Alpha Pro or an Alpha Smart or whatever they're calling them nowadays to type his answers. Or he could be put on a laptop to type his answers. When you have a child who just shuts down and can't write out answers, instead of writing out answers, he might have to answer yes or no questions or true or false questions or multi-choice questions. When you have a child who has visual impairments or is visually disturbed by too much information on a paper, then they only have to have three choices or two choices on the multiple choice instead of four choices. Their term people can – go ahead.
Basically, the difference is that an accommodation is something where you're still keeping the same level of academic work, but you're making it easier for the person because of their – not easier, but making it available for the person with their disability to access the same information or to show what they learned, whereas the modification is where you're actually modifying the academic level of the work.
Yes, they actually modify the core curriculum. And in order for you to have your child do modified grades, that should be on the IEP and you should be signing for it. So if you have a child who has modified grades on the IEP and you're not getting modified grades, that's not implementing the IEP. The other one that I have in my office right now is the mother requested the record. We use a very extensive request that includes logs from all of the service providers, which you're entitled to, if your child's name or identification number is on it. And if there's other kids' information on it, they have to redact that out. And we counted up the service hours that were provided, and only one-third of the hours that the speech and language person told the director of special ed she provided were documented. So they have no way of proving that the child got the services. There's a failure to implement the IEP.
Right, yeah, it's really hard. Those areas are really difficult.
It is. Plus, when you write goals and objectives, the general ed staff are under the assumption that they're not the ones implementing them. Only special ed people do. So if you have a kid who is doing, say, study skills class or a support class and then is in traditional general ed classes for the rest of the day, who's implementing the IEP all day?
Hmm. Yeah. It's really tough.
It is very tough.
But, you know, that's what we're supposed to do as parents. We have to fight for our child's rights, because if we're not doing it, who else will?
That's exactly right. And one of the things that I find that happens, and I did it myself when I was a parent, is we get into IEP meetings, and we are so incensed at some of the things that they say about our children, especially when they start with, well, Johnny just doesn't care about his homework. He could do it if he really wanted to, or he's lazy. That we jump in right away and defend our children. The hardest thing to do in an IEP meeting is to sit there, tape record it, and let the district say what they have to say. Because if you ever get to the point that you can do that, and that's why bringing somebody with you to kick into the table is a good thing, Chantal, so you can get down and the district can be locked in to what their rationale is for something. That way, if you have to go further, then we've already got that information, and an attorney who's going to take it to hearing knows what position the district's going to take. So if they get up on the witness stand and try to take a different position, you are able to counter it, saying, but wait a minute, you said. But sitting still and being quiet is extremely difficult to do in an IEP meeting when it's about your child.
Yes, it really is.
Mm-hmm.
Having filed twice for due process, I remember.
Yes, I would think you would.
Okay, so here's another great question from Gnet Butler in Gillsville, Georgia. What do you do when your child's teacher is told to say nothing in an IEP meeting? The teacher has asked for assistive technology sometime in the year for my son and was told no. I didn't know this till the school year was over. He is now homeschooled because our IEP meetings did nothing to help our son. We live in a small town, and it seems to me the school doesn't follow IDEA law.
Well, you should start with, again, requesting the educational records from the district and look and see if there's any documentation anywhere that the teacher sent in a request for the assistive technology evaluation. If there is, that would have started whatever your state's timelines are. Then you can file a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights for denial of FAPE based upon a known area of need identified by the teacher that the district failed to assess in. That is exactly what the whole process is about, is a known area of need that is assessed is how we write IEPs. Then we get the present levels from that, and then we write our goals and objectives, and then we write everything else that's required in an IEP. So if you have a teacher who has identified somewhere in the records, and most really smart teachers find out a way to put it in there, you can do that. Or you can write a letter to the teacher, like I said before, thanking them for telling you, because you don't tell me how you got the information. If it came from the teacher, write a thank you note to the teacher. Then I turn around and write a letter to the director of special ed saying, I understand that a request was made during this time period for an assistive technology for my son. Please provide it, the assessment plan, because as of right now, it's untimely, again, based upon what the timelines are in your state. And if you choose to ignore this request, I'm going to seek one myself and come after the district for reimbursement of that cost.
What I've been able to do with my school district, which has been helpful, but this is always because actually for quite some time now, I've had teachers that I have good communication with and who are actually trying to do the best and give them the best education. Though I know that in the school district, they have their own battles because you have to realize that the teachers cannot always request of their bosses. It's like asking their bosses for something, and if their bosses are saying no, then it puts the teacher in a hard place. So I always make sure before I go into IEP that I discuss with the teacher what the teacher's needs are in terms of fulfilling the child's IEP, and I get as much information as I can. Again, this works if you're, you know, having a good rapport with the teacher. And then I go in the IEP and I ask the school district for things, not so that the teacher isn't the one having to ask, and it puts, because I have more rights than the teacher. But you do have to feel strong as a parent, and you do have to have all that information to back it up. What do you think about that?
I think it's a good position, although I think you and I have been in IEP meetings where the teacher took one position, the parent actually did that, took a position, and the district took another position and then asked the teacher what she felt. She told the truth, and she lost her job. So teachers do try – most teachers try to do their best because if they don't want life difficult for themselves, and if you, the more parents you've got coming in complaining, the more difficult their life is. So they, on a whole, try to work. There are some that don't, and we all know that, but that's life. There's some attorneys that don't do a good job. There's some doctors that don't do a good job. It's just the way life is. But if any pressure you can keep off the district, off the teacher with the district is always beneficial, and that teacher will feed you more information later on. But when you're at the point that you're having to withdraw your child from school because the IEP is ineffective, I think you're past that point.
Right.
Unless now, I misunderstood your question. Sorry.
No, I understand. I think you understood. There's quite a few questions that have come in about goals and having to Charles asked, what do you do if goals are vague? A few other people asked, what about when it's not listed in the goal dates for when a goal will be reached? What do we do in these situations? And aren't there supposed to be specific timelines on goals written into IEPs?
Well, the law changed again in this area, and districts are no longer required to have objectives that are set at time periods. So now, excuse me?
I am surprised. When did that happen?
Oh, that happened actually a couple of years ago, and there's some project areas where districts are writing IEPs for 3 years, which I think is ridiculous. However, nobody asked me for my opinion at that time. So you no longer find it necessary. A smart district will put goals with objective benchmarks in so that their staff can fall back and look on it. It also helps them to track things much better. The biggest problem that I find with the goals is that when you look at the baseline, some districts call them baseline, some call them just present levels. They should be the same thing. And if they write a baseline or a present level that doesn't tell you anything that you can use to turn into a goal, then you want to ask them more questions to get them to put something in. For instance, numbers from an assessment is not something that you as a parent can use. So if they say Johnny Will is reading at 4.6 grade level, well, that's not what the 4.6 means. The 4.6 means that grade level score, which is actually the least reliable score, it means that someone at the fourth grade 6 months should be able to read what Johnny read, not that Johnny's reading at 4.6. And Johnny will increase that to 5.2. Well, that means they have to use the same test. Well, there's test memory, so we don't like them to use the same test over and over again. So you want them to tell you Johnny can't decode. He can't encode. He adds words in. His lines, his eyes skip lines. He doesn't read with inflection. He has no fluency. He skips over all punctuation so that it's one continuous run-on sentence. You want specific information about where the child is performing for your baseline and your goal. And then you want the goal to line up with it. So if someone's saying, Johnny needs to, the area of need is homework completion. Is it actually homework completion, or is that he can't start his homework, he can't stay on the homework, or he can't complete it, or he can't turn it in and get it from home to school? We want to be real specific in what it is. And so if they say homework is only turned in a couple of days a week, and he's going to now turn it in 100%. Well, first of all, nobody's perfect, so nothing's going to be done at 100%. So where is he now starting so that we know if he's made progress or not? And if they say, well, it's at 80%, then why are you writing a goal? I can't tell you how many times they've written goals for kids. I have one right now who every goal the child met last year, and they're just carrying it forward. Why? There's no need. And you want to have something that's measurable. Let's see, how would that work? Johnny can add and subtract two-digit numbers with regrouping from a field of 10 in 80% of the time. Now you know exactly what he can do. So now you want him to be able to do four numbers, four digits, add and subtract from a group of 10 at 80% a year from now, if math is a really weak area. Most of the times you're going to be jumping up to, he's going to be able to fill out a multiplication chart, or he can will be able to multiply and divide and use things like that. And then if you have a kid who's got a lot of memory issues, is it that the child hasn't memorized their math facts, but do they still get the process? So in other words, Johnny can't remember what 7 times 7 is, but he understands 7 groups of 7. So give him a calculator. The issue is to get them to understand the process. Yes, we would love for them to memorize math facts, but if they can't, this is an assistive technology world. Use of a calculator is wonderful. But I will have to caution you, if you're also teaching a child to dial a telephone, a touch-tone telephone, the numbers for a touch-tone telephone are opposite of that of a calculator. So we've had a lot of kids get confused in trying to remember the numbers. So just an FYI on that. But make sure your goal is measurable. And any time that they want to put two measurements in it, I would ask them to take it out, and also the language. And here's the reason why. Johnny will turn in his homework 80% of the time in 4 or 5 trials. In 4 or 5 trials is 80% of the time, and that means that one day he could turn in nothing, the second day he could turn in 100%, the next day he could turn in 50, or all the way out. And so there's no consistency. You want him to be consistent. So on 4 of the 5 days, you want him to turn in 80%. So it's on, not in, because in makes it a fraction. And I usually just try to get them to say 80% of the days in a 5-day week or something of that matter, so that we're real clear and you're not fighting next year over what the goal really was supposed to be measuring. Or John has 10 signs and he's going to add 5 more functional signs to his repertoire.
Right.
What are the signs he has now? Make sure you identify those. Or using a spelling list, Sam will be able to do A, B, and C. We'll attach the spelling list to show what he can do now so that we're all working on the same thing. A lot of them want to use, well, we're going to use the Dolch sight word list. Okay, attach it, because you want that IEP written so if the child moves to another location, that receiving district knows exactly what the child is working on. And if you don't attach these things, then you don't. Nowadays, on written language, where we used to write, the child will learn how to develop a paragraph. He will write an introductory sentence, a closing sentence, and 3 supporting detail sentences. Now it's he will score a 3 on a district rubric. Well, what's the rubric score? Well, it scores punctuation, grammar, spelling, But that's not what you're asking. You're asking him to put together a paragraph, stay cohesive in his thought process. So then you don't want to use the rubric because you don't want, or if you're going to use, let them use the rubric, then things like the grammar or spelling especially and that stuff should not be counted against them. So you have to be very careful in things like that.
Okay, because you were talking about the homework, Patty from Chicago had asked, she said that her son does not turn in homework consistently, and she wants to know what verbiage she used to ask that I be informed if homework is not turned in. Can she request that she be informed?
You can request that, and again, that communication log that you identified is a very good thing for that to happen, and I'm not clear if the child has done the homework and it's just not getting from his backpack into class. So is someone identified at school who is going to, look at the backpack and pull out the homework folder and or wherever it is and pull it out and give it to him? Or is there a teacher there who's going to ask? And email is a great asset for us now in dealing with teachers because teachers don't mind sending an email saying, no homework turned in today in Spanish, no homework turned in today in reading. And it takes them no time to get that done versus picking up the phone and calling you saying no homework was turned in.
Okay. Well, thanks for clarifying that. Now, a couple people have asked, and I'll read from Remo Frederick. What is No Child Left Behind? And also someone else asked, what is FAPE?
FAPE is a...
I didn't understand what it means, F-A-P-E.
Okay. FAPE is a free... appropriate public education. That's what your child is entitled to. He's not entitled to what they call the Cadillac education. He's entitled to the basic floor of opportunity. And FAPE is when you identify and are able to meet a child's unique educational needs. So when determining if a FAPE has been offered, the only people who are legally entitled to make that determination are your hearing officers. And so in IEP meetings, you will hear districts saying our FAPE offer is, well, it's actually their offer of placement. They're not the ones who get to identify if it's FAPE, if you disagree with it. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay. And what is, for Remo, who's in Frederick, Maryland, what is No Child Left Behind, and how does that relate to us?
No Child Left Behind was standards that were put in place that all children in this country are supposed to meet by, I believe it's 2012, including reading at the fifth grade level and the attributes that and degrees and certificates that people who work in special education and regular education must have and your ability to get that. And if you're in an underperforming school more than 2 years in a row, then that school district or that school site has to offer you either tutoring for your child and or transportation to a different school site that is performing. We have too many schools where you have, for whatever reason, a lot of individuals who don't speak the English or it's a social economical lower area, not to say that that should mean that they can't learn because that's regardless, that's ridiculous, I'm sorry. So some of those areas continue to do poorly. And if they do poorly year after year, you have the right to pull your child out and have them sent someplace else. A lot of parents don't want to put them on a bus and send their kids someplace else, and I can understand that, or don't want them to leave their community. And if that's your option, then you have the right to ask for tutoring after school. They should offer it to you, but I'm finding that that is not really happening. And then you also have the right to know the credentials of the individuals that work with you. For instance, where a special ed teacher who's teaching high school math has to also be credentialed in that subject so that a general certificate for special education teaching doesn't make them capable of teaching history, science, chemistry, any of those courses.
Okay, well, Remo is also asking, my son is attending high school, and since he cannot pass the high school state assessment test, he will have to be in a restricted environment and have to go non-diploma bound. Can we fight this?
Yes. He does not have to go non-diploma bound. He can stay in a diploma track. And, again, I don't know what state you're in. But
he's in Maryland.
Maryland. I don't know the law of Maryland. So I would contact the superintendent of education in your state and ask them what are the accommodations and modifications that are permitted for a child to take your high school exit exam. And what districts, at least in this area, have done is even if your child requires more than what is on the high school exit exam as acceptable, if your child passes it with modifications or accommodations, then you can then file for a waiver to the superintendent of your school district to get that as credit. Unfortunately, too many people have used that, and they wind up with kids 18 years old who should have been able to continue on to their 22 and receive additional services. And the goal is to get them to pass the high school exit exam. So if your child is not able to pass it timely and has to remain in school for a fifth year or a sixth year, the goal should be to keep them moving towards a high school exit exam as well as preparing them for transition services.
Right. Very good. Here's another question that has to do with older students. This is from Cindy Kuhn in Tinley Park. A friend has an 18-year-old, and her district is doing nothing to support her son with job training or anything. I have a sneaking suspicion they have pulled a fast one on her son, and he will not be supported until he is 22. Can you give me any advice for her? I believe her son is deaf in one ear and maybe somewhere on the autism spectrum.
It goes back to what I just talked about the high school exit exam and did he meet the criteria for getting a regular ed diploma. IDEA provides that all children are to be educated who are special ed eligible until they're 22. In California, it's 21 in some states, until they receive a regular ed diploma and or age out. So if this child has not aged out, then he's entitled to continue on in school. I am finding that transition services are very, very poor. Since you're in California, there is a book that's available on transition services that was written by a former hearing officer when the special ed hearing office was doing hearings that you could probably get a copy of that walks you through the transition services. And with the transition services, they're supposed to be bringing in and introducing adult services to the child to provide them services to train them in job training and things like that. The Department of Rehab, mental health, if the child needs to continue with mental health, workability, depending upon each district and what they have in place. Regional center, if the child's autistic, hopefully he was identified before age 18 by regional center as being able to receive services. And each one of these different programs has different things to provide and offer for a child in transition.
Yeah, it's transition services should be really a good thing for a student. They sound good on paper, but unless the district you're in is really doing what they should be doing, it's not very helpful for your child. So you really have to keep an eye on those transition services.
Absolutely. And one of the things with the transition plan is no longer are they supposed to list things. They're supposed to write goals just like they have goals in the IEP. And another thing that you should watch for is letting a district put down that you yourself as the parent and or your child are responsible to implement any goals. The reality is the only reason that's on the IEP is the IEP must identify who in the district is responsible for implementing that goal. You are not responsible to implement a goal. And if they insist that you are responsible to implement a goal, then you identify that you want to be trained so you can implement it. Or they'll say, oh, you don't want your child to be responsible. Well, of course you want your child to be responsible, but he's not responsible, nor is he trained to implement the goal. And that's the only reason that question is on the IEP, and you should not be identified. And there's nothing worse, especially in the transition section, where you see child will get his birth certificate by parent, child will get his social security card by parent, child will get this by parent, child will get that by parent. That's the district's job to teach him how to find out where are these things located, how to make a request for them, how to keep a book or whatever they're going to keep to have all these documents available to them. And parents too often say, okay, I'll do that because, you know, we grew up being respectful to teachers and you don't talk back and of course it's your kid and of course you're going to be responsible to do those things. But in reality, The IEP should be very clear who from the district is responsible to do it, not you.
Right. Good point.
Thank you.
Okay. Here's a question from Michelle Vetlison in Carlsbad, California. My six-year-old was diagnosed with high-functioning Asperger's in February. While he held it together pretty well during his three-hour class, he fell apart huge for hours once home. He will be starting first grade in the fall, a jump to a six-hour day. His psychologist and I are concerned about him making it throughout the day without quiet times to regroup and his social skills that are slipping away. The school thinks things are fine how they are. We are requesting an IEP and evaluations by the school speech for pragmatics and OT for his sensory issues. How do I get the school to understand that he isn't okay and that the jump to the six-hour day is going to be really rough without the proper supports if they haven't noticed the same problems with and without having to let my son fall apart to prove it?
Okay, well, it's not clear if the child is already identified as special ed eligible. If he is, then in addition to asking for the OT and speech and language evaluation, I would ask for a SCIA eval, and that's S-C-I-A. And that's an evaluation that's done in California that looks at if the child requires an aid. And if so, that may be an assistance that he can get for keeping him in school. You can always have a doctor's note written to keep him out of school for 6 hours, but the question is, why is the child falling apart? What does the child require that would allow him to be functional for a six-hour day? The mere fact that a child is diagnosed with any autistic area, PDD, NOS, Asperger's, does not in and of itself qualify a child for special education. The handicapping condition is autistic-like behaviors. And I believe there's 6 or 7 behaviors that are listed there. And your child has to have so many of those, I think it's 3 or 4, in order to qualify under autistic-like behaviors. And I have a lot of parents who get very upset that the doctor identifies them and diagnoses a kid with ADHD or with Asperger's or with autism, and they can't get the district to identify it. And that's because you have to be able to show what's the impact to that of those behaviors to the education. And for the autistic-like behaviors, they have to meet the handicapping condition, and then they have to show the negative impact to the education. So if the child is already eligible, then ask for the SCIA eval, OT, and I wouldn't ask for just speech and language for pragmatics. I would ask for all of it. And OT for sensory and find issues, let them do a full assessment. If they've already had done assessment, I probably would ask for an independent educational evaluation and IEE. Kids Therapy in San Diego is an excellent program that really works hard on that, as well as Chris Vincino. If the child is not already special ed eligible, I would request an assessment for eligibility to include but not be limited to the OT, speech and language, SCIA, and stuff like that. The district is seeing that the child is doing fine in the six-hour day. We just had a district court decision last fall that says that the district has to take into account across all environments. So the fact that he's falling apart when he gets home, I would clearly identify and have that put on the IEP meeting and then say, okay, fine, we want county mental health brought in and bring in county mental health who can also provide some services to your child. 6 years old is
very common that they fall apart afterwards, yes, because they've been holding it together all
absolutely
day, feel safe at home, and so that's where they let loose. And that's why a lot of times some of these kids do need, like, those sensory breaks or self-requested timeouts, if you will.
Yes, and the sad thing for me is that not every OT really knows how to look at sensory integration.
Correct. You have to really be careful no matter what state you're in,
yes,
to find an OT that knows about sensory integration. And also, because OT is, I know this because of OT being such an important factor for my son.
Yes.
Always ask the right questions. First of all, the OT has to know about sensory integration, also has to know about your type of autism the child has. For example, I make the mistake of asking someone if they had experience with autism. Oh, yeah, you know, 10 or 12 years experience. Well, it turns out they were experienced with kids with Asperger's. So when it came time to try and teach my son certain things, they just couldn't do it. And it didn't matter how many years of sensory integration they had because they were not about, you know, a good professional would be able to transfer it, but this person could not. And the other thing that's important to know is that sensory integration is carried out differently with children depending on their age. So how you do sensory integration activities with a little child, a 6 or 7 year old child, is going to be totally different from how you do it to a 14 and 15 year old. So you want to make sure you have someone who has experience in the age group that you're dealing with. Just little tidbits there.
Very good.
I have a comment here from someone, so I'll let you answer it first, and then I'll answer it from the parent perspective.
Okay. I'm not a parent anymore? I'm not a parent anymore?
Well, you are, but you're also here as the attorney.
Okay.
This is, again, from Remo. Why do you always feel them against us at an IEP meeting?
I thought you were going to answer it. Oh, you want me to answer it first?
You want me to go first? Okay, I'll answer first because I'm not an attorney, and I will say that I have never, ever, at the very beginning, ever felt that it's them against us. That is not my outlook at all. But over the years, depending on the group of people at the IEP meeting, I can see who is really a team player and who is not. And I don't mean that people have to agree with me. That's not the point. The point is you can tell when people are really trying to be part of a team and trying to do what is best for the child. And yet there are certain times I'm in a situation where it's very clear that some of the people at a meeting really are not looking at the child as an individual. And so it does become them against us if they are not listening. If you're not with team players who are listening and taking into account what everyone at the table is saying, they've already come in there with an idea in their mind, and they say things like, well, this is the way we do it in this school district, or they say things like, we don't provide OT here at this district after seventh grade. You know, that's not based on the individual's need. So if someone's coming in with that, it clearly then becomes them against us. But I never, ever, ever in my life start out with that kind of attitude, though sometimes it becomes the way that way. And your point of view, Patty, as an attorney?
My belief is that my job is to come in, analyze what is going on, what the child's needs are, and work with the family and make me the focal point that the district might be upset with rather than my client. Because when I leave, the client has to still stay there, and that child has a long time to be in the district. I have focused and worked very, very hard at establishing really solid relationships with school districts. So I typically do not get that. I get it more from parents who go into IEP meetings when they truly believe that it's going to be a collaborative effort, which it's supposed to be, and they find that the district comes in and says, here's the program, here it is. Or the parent that is the principal's best friend and is there every day in PTA and just can't understand why she's not doing her a favor. So those situations, then it's my job to come in and cool everybody down and get the focus back on the child. And if anybody wants to be angry at me. Don't be angry at the family. But I have been in IEP meetings where everybody was angry and it was them against us type situation. And it's very, very difficult to get anything done in those IEP meetings. So I always try to have my clients rise above it, not get into an argument with the district because you're not going to change their mind and they're not going to change yours. That's why the dissent is so strong in that you can identify everything they said that you disagree with and why you disagree with it and support it with information.
Right. I think it's really important that parents remember that even though we do feel emotional about our kids, we have to remember that it is like a business meeting in the sense that everything that is going to be set out for the child is based on facts. It's not going to be based on emotions. So you really have to get past the emotions and focus on the facts.
Right. Establishing your child's needs, how it's impacting them in school, and how it needs to be addressed. Those are your keys.
Correct. Also, just to clarify, Patty, isn't it true that goals and objectives are what drive the IEP placement? So in other words, if you are, say, wanting to have your child mainstreamed or included, fully included, besides the fact that it's their right to be in the least restrictive environment, don't the goals and objectives somehow have to reflect that?
Not necessarily. The IEP itself, the total document, once you have everything into it, then you look where there, what's the least restrictive environment that can be implemented. So many times districts will say, well, okay, we've written the goals and objectives, and everybody's going to agree to them, and we want you, we're going to place your child, we're offering special day classes, the FAPE placement. Well, what about the related services? Oh, well, that's contained in the program, and you just get what the program has. No, 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 no. The whole IEP has to be written. And again, remember, it's always assumed that a child can be educated in regular ed. It's up to the district to establish why they cannot. There's child disturbing another kid, or they'll say, well, academically, they're just not going to get the same thing they get in a special day class. That may be true, but socially, they may get more. So you have to be really prepared and know what your kids' needs are, how they can be addressed, and where that can be addressed. And if they fight you on that, then you're going to have to write your dissent and be able to document all the reasons why. But they get in, I find they get in there, and it's, well, we want to put them in the place where they're going to learn the best. But learn what? The best. It depends upon the level that your child is capable of learning. And if it's social skills that they need, then they need to be with typically developing peers, not in a special day class.
Okay. Here's a great question from Noni in Apple Valley, California. We are having a major problem with transportation. They do not get here early enough to get my son to school on time that we set in the IEP. They said to get him there on time, they would have to pick him up way before school starts, like an hour or two ahead. They're trying to squeeze him into other pickups and drop-offs. What can I do to make them be compliant, as is transportation even obligated to follow the IEP?
You can identify every day what time he gets to school, and then identify that you're going to go after them for comp ed, since they are failing to get him to school on time. The IEP team must decide what is the appropriate amount of time for that specific child and their needs to be on a bus. There are some kids who can get on a bus, and an hour ride is no big deal. But there's some kids that more than 20 minutes is not appropriate unless there's an aide sitting there, and some that 20 minutes is never going to be appropriate. So the IEP team must make that recommendation, and I caution you, because I have lots of special ed teachers, or, sorry, directors of special ed who will say, well, I don't run transportation. No, you don't, but you do identify the individual needs of the child. And if they're refusing to do that, again, you've got an OCR complaint. If they're refusing to document for you what time your child gets there, if you can afford the time to be there at school and document it yourself, then you can present that to somebody who has the ability to make change in your district.
Okay. Here's a question from Colleen in Roy. I don't know where that is. My son has been locked in a timeout room and put into a timeout room upwards of 10 times a day. What can you do to prevent this? Or what can I do to prevent this?
Well, first of all, is it in the IEP that you've consented to the use of a timeout room? If not, then you can remind them in writing that you have not agreed to a timeout room, and that's a violation of his rights. Not knowing what state it's in, I don't know what your process is for looking at it. If a child is needing that much intervention to be restricted from being with others, then he should at least have a behavior support plan or goals, which they are proving by the amount of time that he's spending in this timeout room are not effective. So then you need to look at a functional analysis. What are the triggers, the antecedents to the behavior, and what is he getting from the behavior that needs to be changed? And from that, then they write a behavior intervention plan. And if that doesn't work, then he needs a change in placement.
Okay. Here's a good one from Renee in Minnesota, I think it is. I have a teenager on the ASD with Asperger's. He's going into the 11th grade. Is it best for him to start joining in with the IEP process? And what help can I give him to be a self-advocate for himself?
Well, you can write goals and objectives that the child learns to start being utilizing self-advocacy skills and learning them. So that requires basically social skills class and with somebody orchestrating, you know, how you do that. You can start thinking about introducing your child. I don't know what your child's level of cognition is or emotional stability. If the child can go in and be in a room with a lot of adults who are talking about him and not be upset, then maybe. But I don't know many children who can do that. So with my kids, I typically don't bring them in until the end. And at the end, we very quietly explain that the team met, we heard great things about you. There's a couple of areas we're going to work on and help you with. They are A, B, C, and D. Do you have any questions for us? And slowly introduce them in, because if they can't go in and maintain the appropriate social skills in that environment or get upset there, that comes back to school the next day and stays with them. So I try to be very cautious before I suggest that a child come to an IEP meeting.
I think it also depends on the IEP meeting. Like, for example, the last couple of years, which is different from prior years in the past, it's very smooth IEP meetings for my son. And also there's the fact that when they are at a certain age, they are supposed to be giving some kind of input to the IEP.
Absolutely.
So I've found, and you can do that without actually being at the IEP meeting, of course, but I have found that for teaching self-help, self-advocacy skills, being a part of the IEP team meeting process has been really helpful for my son. But again, at first he started out by just writing something that was read during the IEP meeting and then attached to the IEP. Then he would come in and just stay for a little bit. And this time, for the first time, he really wanted to come and to attend the whole time. And it was something that I was okay with, and so were the other team members, because we were all in agreement, basically, about where we were going with the IEP, and also because Jeremy had given an enormous amount of input into his IEP. Now, Jeremy is severely impacted by autism and has a little bit of verbal skills, but not very many, but he can still communicate by pointing on a letter board and on his assistive technology device, so he's able to give input. But the fact that he could sit and listen also was really good, because it made him responsible for, I mean, responsible not in the sense of he's not responsible, there's someone else like the teacher or the OT, but he, a lot of these goals are goals that he knew and he agreed upon. So in other words, we have his buy-in to help work on them, which makes it a lot easier when you're talking about someone who's 20, which
it
is different than when you're dealing with a 7-year-old.
But I think you hit the key. You all agreed upon it, and they all knew him, and they all knew, know how to deal with Jeremy. When you're going in and you're having to fight for something, it is so difficult to have a child in there watching their parent fighting with their teacher, and or they feel the need to defend the parent or defend the teacher. It's a very ugly scene.
Right. Okay, here's a good question from Maria Duke in Hanover. My son has responded very well to the rapid prompt technique as part of his private speech therapy, but the therapist at school does not believe in this technique. I attended both the private sessions and some of the ones at school, and the performances are so different. How can I convince the speech and language pathologist at school to try this approach?
Well, first of all, methodology is exclusively the right of the district staff to make the decisions on. If you want to win your related service providers over, or even your teachers over, one thing you might do is sign a release to have the private therapist and the therapist at school communicate with each other and exchange information. And then maybe your private therapist would go to school and observe and invite that therapist back to their program and say, let me show you what I'm getting out of him doing this. Then it's a peer relationship thing, and you're kind of out of it, and they work it out amongst themselves. But the reality is the district has the right to select the methodology.
Interesting.
Unless you can establish that it is not working.
I always find in those situations when you're using something like the rapid prompting method, which is not there's no research behind it at this point either.
Correct.
So it's really hard to convince people. The only way to convince people is by the child showing them. And so
yes.
I found if you're in a district where people are willing to look at the child, if they come and observe what, as Patty has said, at a therapy session, and then they try it and they see that they're getting results, oftentimes they will want to use it. But it's not. It's so much easier if it's the child to convince them than the parents demanding.
Absolutely. And remember, you still have to work with that teacher, and there may be other things that you want. So it's kind of like a pick your battle and put peers with peers and let the peers deal with it. So if you put a speech and language pathologist with another speech and language pathologist, they can usually find some common ground.
Right. Now, here's a good question. Tony from Oak Park, what if the school disciplines child for behaviors that are part of a disability? How do you handle that?
If they're part of, well, first of all, I don't know what you mean by discipline. Clearly, if the child is a danger to self or others, they have the right to do some discipline, and an ADHD or a bipolar child and even some severe autistic children have problems where their behavior becomes violent and they have to be restrained and or placed in timeout rooms or things like that, or taken out of the classroom or other kids are removed from the area that they're in. So I'm not quite clear on what the exact situation is, but if the child is consistently having behaviors, then you need to have them do a functional analysis and look at the antecedents to the behaviors and what the child is communicating or getting from the behaviors. Because remember, all a behavior is a communication in some shape or form. So what is the child really trying to tell them that somebody isn't getting?
Okay. Let me
just add to that. The IEP team should look at each of those behaviors and then decide what could be done for each of the behaviors. And that's where the behavior intervention plan or the behavior support plan is so important, because it'll identify the behaviors, what it looks like before the behavior is happening, so that there can be some reaction prior to the behavior occurring rather than reaction afterwards.
Okay. Darcy Leon from Sheridan, Wyoming asks, what happens when your core IEP team does not want your child to have summer school because they don't have a program?
That's not the definition of what extended school year is, and I'm assuming that you mean summer school for a special needs kid. And if your child the purpose of having an extended school year for children is so that they don't lose skills that take longer than the other kids normally take to recover them in the fall. So if you can establish that your child does not have or has a history of when he's on long periods of time where he's not receiving services, that his skills become so regressed that when he comes back in the fall, it's like till November or December when the other kids are back in swing in October, and you can document that through the IEP report, the IEPs itself, through the report cards, through comments that you've gotten from teachers, then you're entitled to push for extended school year, which could be a private placement, private tutoring, if the school doesn't have a program themselves, with reimbursement from the district and or the district funding directly.
Okay. Here's Monique from Warwick. My twin sons were going to a preschool program full-time from 9 o'clock till 2, and in April they said my son scored high in testing and said because of this he does not need school services, just OT and speech. So they completely took them out of the school program, and since they've been home they have regressed, which was my concern, which I told them. So I guess my question is, can my son still be in a preschool program? If so, how do I go about doing this? Please help. I feel like the school district isn't helping at all.
It goes back to the original thing I talked about. Did you sign the IEP and agreed to remove them from the school? If you didn't, then you can file for due process and force them to put them back in the school as part of automatic stay put. If they've already removed them, then you need to sign a written request for an evaluation and start all over again. Or you can say you disagree and file for due process.
Okay. Somebody in San Diego, Michelle Wandrock, says, my son with PDD NOS just tested in the 98th percentile of the California Gifted and Talented Education Test. He is now eligible to be in a GATE class. How do I get this into his IEP as a permanent record for future placement?
Well, congratulations.
Yes.
And I don't know that you want it part of the IEP, because the IEP, although it's part of the permanent records, they're confidential and they have more protections on them than the CUME file. So you may not want to share that later on. Be that as it may, you can convene an IEP team meeting and or have one, your next one, have them identify in the IEP team meeting notes that your son is now eligible for GATE and or in the GATE class or however you want it put in there. And if they don't, then you do it by descent. But I would bet that if you file or request for educational records on your son, it's already in his file that he's GATE eligible, because there's an actual sheet of paper that has the GATE score on it, especially like if they use the Ravens, it'll have the 98th percentile or whatever else they used in, if it wasn't the Ravens, and that's already part of his educational record.
Cindy Kuhn, again, from Tinley Park. How can I get the school to make good measurable goals for adulthood, which is coming around the corner? I get really bad goals like appropriate commenting during board games. I don't feel this will help him ask for assistance when he needs help at a store, restaurant, et cetera. They never write anything for real life skills.
I just reviewed a IEP that had the same problem. And what you want to do is come in prepared to present your own goals and dissent to what their goals are, saying that, one, they're not measurable, they don't meet the legal standard, and, two, it doesn't prepare them for adulthood and or getting a job, which is what a transition plan does. So your goals, you want to have things like John will go out and obtain four applications for work. And then you want to write another goal that he will learn to fill them out, and or he will have the documentation in that file that I talked about that they're going to get with their birth certificate and their Social Security card and all that information, that documentation, so that it provides that he has it available to him and he can learn to fill it out based upon that documentation. Same thing with building a resume for him. There are things that he does during his school day that can go down on the resume as things that he is doing. Like, is he able to take and hand out the papers in the classroom? Does he take notes to the office? Does he deliver memos that the office wants? There's lots of things on campus that these kids can do that help build up a resume. Does he recycle at home? Then he's part of working on a recycling team with you and him and whoever else is working in recycling. And you take the recycling to school and you have it worked out that they go in there and take it to a recycling place. But he should be in a program that, if those are the issues that the district has provided, where they go to, they learn to do a budget, they decide what they're going to make, they go to the grocery store, they learn to do dollar up for making change, they learn to make the purchases, they learn how to say hello, how are you, look them in the eye, all those kinds of things should already be in a transition plan, which is required to be in effect at age 16.
Right. Diana Alvarado from Madera. Hi, if I signed an initial that I was present and agreed to part one of the IEP, and on continuation, part two of the IEP, I reinitialed and redated that I was present, but I did not re-sign or redate on part two, day two of the IEP, accepting the offer of FAPE. Can the county use my signature on part one of the IEP as my acceptance of their offer of FAPE?
They can try. The problem is going to be, how do you identify what was in the IEP from the first go-round to the versus now if they just expanded the IEP document?
I guess if you taped it, you would have it on record, but that would be about it.
Perhaps, but again, they could have a draft copy, you know, that they say, you know, this is what she was provided, and then you have your copy, and then a hearing officer has to make the decision, which was the actual document. And I'm assuming that your first IEP meeting was for eligibility and your second one was for placement and services. So I would, in that case, I would ask them for a second sign-in sheet. I would not re-sign on the same sheet that belongs to one IEP meeting to the next one, because it does complicate things. And what's the cost of one piece of paper? It's not like you're asking them to do a lot of stuff. And remember that these are public agencies. So each state has a law that's similar to the Freedom of Information Act. And under the Freedom of Information Act, you're entitled to any policies and procedures of any public agency. So when you're in a meeting and the district says, well, it's not our policy to have a different signature page, you write the superintendent a letter saying, I would like a copy of that policy, and you have to be as specific as policy as to what they said was the policy. The policy that directs that a second IEP page cannot be used when there's two, it's a two-part IEP meeting, and then the parent must sign this one. And you want to be specific to the school site as well as to the district. They have to make that available to you. California has their own, and I'm assuming each state has their own also.
Great. We have time for one quick question. This is Jeff in Michigan. At our IEP, that's the famous lines that we can't do this or we don't, or those are not available to our district. For example, we asked for an alpha mate to help our son with his writing. They said those are not available in our district. What can we do to get them to provide general accommodations such as these?
Well, an alpha mate isn't necessarily a general accommodation, and before you get to that point, you usually have an assistive technology evaluation, so I would start there. And you want them to look at not only assistive technology tools, the hardware tools, but you also want them to look at software. So if it's that your son isn't able to do math skills and you can use a computer program to work on that, that's one way. If you want them to use it for written language or language arts or for kids who don't read well, that they can type into a program and the program can be set to read it back to them by word, by sentence, by paragraph, by page. Those are big helps to kids who are struggling in reading and written language, but it all starts with an assistive technology evaluation, and that requires a written request to the district.
And they have to provide that.
Well, if they don't, again, you identify, you know, district's failure to provide this assessment will result in my family seeking one independently and reimbursement from the district.
Okay. Very good. Well, Patty, that's about all the time that we have today. I want to thank you for being our guest speaker today. Can you do you want to tell the listeners where your office is, or do you want to give out any of that information? Because people have been asking where it is that you practice.
Certainly. I have an office in Encinitas, California, which is in the San Diego area. I practice in approximately four or sometimes five counties down in the southern part of California. I have gone into other states. I can be reached at S as in Sam, P as in Peter, E as in Edward, D as in David, A as in Apple, T as in Tom, and Y as in Yo-Yo for special ed attorney at gmail.com. My office number is 760-632-1748. Best way to reach me is email, and I will be gone for the next 2 weeks on vacation, but I'm answering emails.
Well, thank you so much, Patty.
Well, thank you for
again,
the pleasure of speaking to your group.
Oh, you're welcome. I mean, we're so glad that you were able to make it. This has been a webinar on MomsFightingAutism.com. I've been your moderator, Chantal Cecile Kira. And you can get other information on MomsFightingAutism.com and information about me on ChantalCecileKira.com. So please join us again for our future webinars. And thanks again, Patty. And I hope you have a great vacation.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Bye now.
Okay, to all listeners, enjoy the summer, wherever it is that you
going to go play grandma.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.